Hello, you are listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 9, Reaction and Recovery. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades, and welcome back. Last time, we left the Bolsheviks in a bit of a tough spot. After the failed insurrection of the July days, their leaders were either arrested or in hiding to avoid arrest. Their newspapers were shut down, and the new Kerensky government vowed to crush the Bolsheviks in retaliation for attempting to overthrow the government, which, you will recall, was a false accusation, since the Bolsheviks as a party neither instigated nor led the insurrection at any point. The most that could be said is that some of the Bolshevik leaders did give in to pressure from the workers and soldiers engaged in the insurrection and gave their endorsement of their actions. But just as many, if not more, leaders, including Lenin himself, were vehemently against the insurrection and tried to stop it. Today, we will go a bit more into the details of the post-July days period. Specifically, we will talk about the reaction to the Bolsheviks among the general population and the official response from the provisional government to the party and the workers. Then we'll see how the Bolsheviks weathered the storm surprisingly well, which allowed them to engage in serious internal debate about the best course of action for moving forward. In the end, we will see they were able to position themselves for a political comeback which, if anyone had predicted just weeks prior, would have seemed not only unlikely, not only impossible, but absolutely absurd to imagine. Until it happened. To start, once the dust settled from the insurrection, bodies were lying in the streets. Although, as was mentioned last time, there were not nearly as many as you might think, only around 30 or so dead. But the provisional government, now led by Alexander Kerensky, made the decision to hold up in particular 7 Cossacks killed in the fighting as the martyrs of the July days. Both the government and the Petrosoviet helped spread the word about how these brave patriots had been killed fighting to save the homeland and the revolution from the German agents who had tried to deliver Russia into the hands of the Kaiser. Papers everywhere published obituaries full of tributes praising the fallen Cossacks to the stars. The goal was simple: generate as much patriotic sympathy for the Cossacks, and by proxy for the government, as possible. And boy, did it work. But first, a quick sidebar. What the hell is a Cossack? This is not the place to explore the Cossacks in any kind of depth, so a brief description will have to suffice. The term Cossack refers to groups of traditionally nomadic peoples of the southern steppes of Russia and Ukraine. The Cossacks were not a monolith. There was no single shared ethnicity or language between the various groups. But they did share a few traits in common. They were very proud of their history and heritage, usually leading traditionally nomadic steppe lives well into the 20th century. They were renowned for their military skill and particularly for their horsemanship. And most notably, they were fiercely independent. Because of these traits, throughout the history of the Russian Empire, the Tsars were never quite able to do away with or subdue the Cossacks entirely. And so instead, a deal was struck. The Cossacks would be allowed a great deal of autonomy within the Russian Empire in exchange for military service to the Tsars. And this arrangement made a lot of sense for both sides. The Cossacks were almost all Orthodox Christian, which meant they were politically and socially very conservative, which is just what the Tsars were looking for. The Cossacks garnered a reputation as crack military units, and at this point in our story, their allegiance was to the provisional government, which they saw as the legitimate heir to the Tsars. In any event, the Cossacks were definitely not sympathetic in the least to leftists of any stripe. Socialist, anarchist, it didn't matter. The fastest way to get a Cossack to draw his weapon against you was to say you were a socialist. And so it made perfect sense that, in the wake of a failed leftist insurrection, the government would make as much hay as possible out of the deaths of 7 Cossack soldiers. A large state funeral was held on the 15th of July and was attended by Kerensky and other government and Soviet officials. Kerensky gave a speech in which he decried the Bolsheviks as German agents, traitors to Russia, and enemies of freedom, democracy, and the revolution. The rest of the details of the funeral are not particularly important to us here, except we can say it really was a grand, solemn, stately affair. What is important is that Kerensky's speech at the event was not an outlier. His rhetoric was not unique at that time. In fact, the funeral took place at the height of the backlash against the workers and the Bolsheviks, and it is to that backlash we now turn. We're going to approach this question from a few separate angles. First, we will discuss the general state of affairs for the people of Petrograd. Then, we'll turn to specifically how the Bolsheviks were treated. But even here, there are layers. There will be the, quote, unofficial response, that is, how certain groups and individuals behaved toward the Bolsheviks, but without any official backing from the provisional government. Then, we'll talk about the, quote, official response, that is, the steps the government took and the policies it pursued to try to put an end to the Bolshevik Party once and for all. For most of the rest of the month of July 1917, and even into August, it was difficult and often dangerous to be in any way affiliated with, or even suspected of being affiliated with, the Bolsheviks. After the collapse of the insurrection, all the papers, conservative, liberal, socialist, it didn't matter, pushed the Lenin and the Bolsheviks are German agents narrative everywhere and often, which provoked a fierce patriotic outcry. Leading the charge in the streets was a group called the Black Hundreds. The Black Hundreds were a far-right, ultra-nationalistic militia group that openly supported the Tsar. They first formed during the Revolution of 1905, in response to both the workers' movement in action that year, as well as stirrings from various nationalities for independence from the Russian Empire. And yes, we have up to now completely neglected the question of nationalities in the Russian Empire and the Revolution. But fear not, we absolutely will circle back around and talk about this, and many other topics, which we are skipping right now in the interest of time and a condensed narrative about the Revolution. Anyway, the Black Hundreds targeted workers, Jews, non-Russians, and left-wing and socialist party members in the streets of Petrograd and other cities. They even had a history of murder and assassination of non-Russian members of the Duma. In 1905, Lenin had immediately identified the Black Hundreds for what they were, the armed reaction of the entrenched interests of the nobility and bourgeoisie to the workers' movement and the revolution, which he pointed out was why they were given such leniency from the authorities, and often were mobilized by them. Although the Black Hundreds were not officially affiliated with any specific political party or group, that did not stop them from collaborating with other right-wing forces, or from garnering support from landowners, business owners, and even the clergy of the Russian Orthodox Church. For much of July 1917, the Black Hundreds could be seen roaming the streets of Petrograd, and were always quick to anger and violence if they came across any outspoken workers or leftists in public. Reports came in of the risk individuals ran of discussing the Bolsheviks in anything but the most derogatory terms in public. Whether you were on the street, or public transportation, or even just in the banyas or public bathhouses, speaking up for the Bolsheviks, pushing back against the German agents narrative, or simply expressing doubt in the rumors by suggesting the party was not entirely what the press insisted they were. All this was enough to elicit anger and possibly violence, either from your interlocutor or some Black Hundreds thug who happened to overhear you. But petty street violence was not the only thing with which the workers now had to contend. In a move that belied the class struggle that lay at the heart of the revolution, business and factory owners seized the moment to try to gain the upper hand over their workforces. Taking advantage of the unpopularity of the Bolsheviks and the disorganized state of the workers' movement, lockouts and layoffs became the weapon of choice, and were used often throughout July in greater numbers than the first half of the year. The numbers of lockouts and layoffs did eventually taper off a bit, but they were still high through October relative to the first half of the year. But okay, so in the court of public opinion, the Bolsheviks and their supporters were guilty and sentenced to endless harassment. But what about the provisional government? It too took the opportunity to attempt to both assert its dominance over the Soviets and the populace, and to do away with the Bolsheviks for good. The first and perhaps most important step was to order that workers must turn over their weapons. The official reason was that the government needed to send those arms and munitions to the front. but the actual reason was clear to everyone. Take away the weapons the workers had used to threaten the government just days before. There were also summary executions of mostly soldiers, but also some civilians, who were believed to have participated in the uprising. Although no reliable figures exist, it is believed thousands were executed. Also, after having been outlawed in early March, the death penalty in the army was reinstated at the war front on the 12th of July, ostensibly to be used in cases of cowardice and disobedience. The significance of this reversal in policy toward the rank-and-file soldier was not lost on anyone. But these were all just general policies applicable to the population at large. The Bolsheviks specifically were targeted in a variety of ways. Their district offices were frequently raided and closed by army units hostile to the party. Although it is interesting to note here that these actions, while undertaken by government actors, were not government sanctioned. What I mean by that is, usually offices were closed on the orders of rogue, mid-level military officers, so definitely an agent of the state, exercising his authority as an agent of the state. But his action was not official government policy. Of course, just like with the Black Hundreds, who were committing stochastic violence against the workers and their activists, the government still could have stopped them. Responsible officers could have been punished for their actions, and the party offices could have been reopened. The Black Hundreds could have been arrested themselves for their violent activities. All this could have been done in defense of the revolution and in the name of the rule of law, freedom, and democracy. All the things that Kerensky's government was now proudly and loudly defending by going after the Bolsheviks. But somehow, that never happened. It was almost as if Kerensky was not actually interested in defending any of those things, as if the provisional government was not actually there to protect the revolution, but to consolidate its own power and go after its enemies. But rogue state actors are still an unofficial response to the Bolsheviks. What did Kerensky and the provisional government themselves do to target the Bolsheviks specifically? We already know that nearly all the Bolshevik papers were shut down, and this was by government decree. Specifically, the loss of Pravda, which again means the truth, and Soldatskaya Pravda, which means soldier's truth, were heavy blows to the party's ability to organize. The party did eventually get new papers up and running only a few short weeks later, but given the compressed timeline of the revolution, a few weeks of going dark meant the party really fell behind. But that's not all. If you were a Bolshevik in Petrograd at this time, if you were not being harassed by private militias or rogue state agents, you were probably being arrested and placed in prison by government decree. I mentioned last time that Kamenev was arrested, while Zinoviev and Lenin were able to slip away into the underground before their warrants were served. But besides Kamenev, Trotsky was eventually arrested, although not until the 25th of July. Someone we have not quite met yet, but will get to in due time, one Anatoly Vasilievich Lunacharsky, was also arrested, and these three were held, along with many others, in the most famous prison in Petrograd, Kresty, or the Crosses, so named for having a series of buildings in the shapes of, you guessed it, crosses. But this was far from the only facility where Bolsheviks were detained. Alexandra Mikhailovna Kolontai was held in a women's prison in the Vyborg district. The 2nd District Militia Headquarters also held inmates. And over a dozen Bolsheviks were held under guard in hospital for medical care. Now, to be fair, conditions in these prisons were dramatically better than they had been under the Tsar. The prison guards were rather lenient, likely in order to hedge their bets. With everything so fluid, who knew if any of these individuals would eventually make it not only out of prison, but into power? In the Crosses, prisoners were often allowed free association during the day, with cell doors open to allow individuals to come and go. Prisoners were also furnished with writing materials upon request, so many decided to work on memoirs and write letters. Trotsky, for his part, was almost constantly at his desk in his cell, writing memoirs, articles, letters, and even political pamphlets. As time went on, though, a funny thing happened with these prisoners. Nothing at all. It appears that the plan from the authorities was to let the imprisoned Bolsheviks languish, as there was absolutely no expediency or sense of urgency in processing, or in some cases even formally charging, those who had been arrested. This prompted more and more letters demanding their cases be addressed, all the way into August. And as we will see soon enough, it was not just the imprisoned who were demanding either trial or release for themselves. Many of the workers joined in with their own cries demanding the same. So, okay, this is not good. Many of their leaders are in prison or in hiding. The workers' movement is in disarray, with government orders that their weapons be turned in. The business owners are putting the screws to the workers. And Bolsheviks and workers all over the city are being harassed and beaten by roving gangs and rogue military units. Things are pretty dire for the Bolsheviks, right? They've got to be just barely holding on, right? Well, incredibly enough, the answer is yes and no, but more, no. Obviously, being a Bolshevik or worker during this period was not easy. But it turns out Kerensky's bark was worse than his bite. And this was because all the invective directed at the Bolsheviks, all the street violence and arrests and raids, the orders from the workers to disarm, even the grand, patriotic, stately funeral for the fallen Cossacks could not disguise one simple fact. The provisional government, and Kerensky now as its leader, was deeply, deeply unpopular among the proletariat. If you are enjoying this show, and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. I have been thinking of how best to show my appreciation for my supporters, and I have a few different ideas in the works. Early access on Patreon, without mid-show plugs like this, is definitely coming soon. But that's not all. Once we get past the revolutionary period and the Civil War, there will be polling to help me figure out what subjects you want me to cover. I even have an ambitious plan to bring the voices of still-living Soviet citizens to the show. I haven't quite worked everything out yet, but I am very excited at this and a few other ideas. So please, head over to patreon.com/sovietpod to support the show. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. We must start our understanding of how ineffective the reaction was with the state of the provisional government during this period. I did not mention this last time because plenty of other things were happening in early July, but the first coalition government, the one that had been formed in the wake of the April crisis and Milyukov's note, which we discussed in episode 6, actually collapsed on the 2nd of July, when many of the cadet ministers resigned in protest over policy toward Ukrainian nationalists. But before anyone could make any moves toward forming a second coalition, street demonstrations began, as we know, the very next day. Obviously, that took up all the attention of the government and its ministers. Once the immediate threat from the insurrection passed, Kerensky was only able to form a second coalition government on the 24th of July, this time with a cabinet composed of only a handful of cadets and a majority of the non-Bolshevik socialist parties. This means that for nearly three absolutely crucial weeks, when the Bolsheviks were in their most disorganized state during the entire revolutionary period, there was no actual functioning government in Russia. Kerensky simply did not have the institutional capacity to actually enforce his persecution of the Bolsheviks. Add to this what I said right before the break, that the provisional government was still incredibly unpopular, and we can understand how it did not take much for the workers and the Bolsheviks to resist some of the more severe measures Kerensky was trying to pursue. Take, for example, the disarming of the workers. A very small number of workers voluntarily complied with this order and turned over their weapons. But the majority did not, which meant if the government wanted to enforce the order, they would actually have to enforce it. At first, the government raided factories and other locations where they believed arms were being stored. But these raids rarely turned up large caches, instead netting only a handful of personal arms. Thus, the main impact of these raids was to exacerbate attitudes toward the government among the workers. The meager results of the raids meant that disarming the workers would require even more force. Go into homes, increase raids, break up workers' meetings, that sort of thing. But the government knew full well that such a move would very likely provoke yet another armed insurrection. And so, despite the official government order to disarm the workers of Petrograd, the majority of workers managed to retain their weapons. Another sign of weakness of the provisional government was the treatment of the arrested Bolsheviks. As I mentioned before, almost none of them were ever actually prosecuted in court. But this was not just the plan of the government. It was more something the government was forced into doing. First and foremost, the cases against many of the arrested were flimsy, and had they been publicly charged, tried, and allowed to defend themselves and address the public, there was no guarantee that it would not end in total embarrassment and fiasco for the government. But a second reason for the lack of formal prosecution was that, from an organizational point of view, the government lacked the institutional capacity to address such a large issue. Between coalitions, still contending with the Soviets as an alternative political center, and without comprehensive and established bureaucratic and judicial systems that could handle the volume of cases, the provisional government could not have proceeded with prosecution, even if it had wanted to. All these factors, the lack of material means to actually disarm the workers, the persistent distrust and animosity among the workers and soldiers toward the government, and its institutional weakness, combined to prevent Kerensky from delivering a knockout blow to the Bolsheviks. Now, at this point, I'm sure some of you are wondering, wait a minute, I thought you were saying the Bolsheviks were massively unpopular. The press was fanning the flames of animosity toward them. Kerensky gave a speech at a state funeral denouncing them as traitors. Hundreds have been arrested, and bands of Black Hundreds are walking the streets of the capital beating workers with impunity. But now the government can't actually decisively beat the Bolsheviks? Daniel, please make this make sense. I'd love to. And to find the answer to this puzzle, we turn now to the Bolsheviks themselves to see how they were weathering the storm. Because if you thought a group of militant, diehard, anti-capitalists were going to take a capitalist crackdown on them lying down, well, you have another thing coming. The explanation lies in the fact that the hostility being directed at the Bolsheviks was coming from workers and soldiers who had never joined and had remained skeptical of the party, as well as petty bourgeois elements in the city, including the other quote-unquote socialist parties, the cadets, and, again, the Black Hundreds. Despite these pressures, however, there was no mass exodus from the party. To the shock of many, in almost all city districts, the numbers of those leaving the party during this period counted in the dozens, possibly hundreds in some of the larger districts. This was, in the end, an insignificant number of members lost. And as we remember from previous episodes, as 1917 wore on, the majority of workers in Petrograd were either members of or supported the Bolshevik Party. No mass exodus meant this held true throughout this crucial period. This, in turn, meant that the provisional government picking a fight with the Bolsheviks was picking a fight with the majority of the working class in the capital, the same working class they had been so far unsuccessful in disarming. And remember, even though Lenin had been against the insurrection on the basis of long-term strategy, even he knew, as did everyone else, that the workers absolutely could have arrested or even killed members of the government. So, for all the bluster coming from Kerensky and the press that the Bolsheviks were done for, despite all the repression aimed at the party on paper, there was just no killing stroke to be had. And so the party was actually able to find its footing after the July uprising in remarkably fast fashion. For example, the Bolshevik Central Committee had 9 members on it, of which only one was actually in prison, Lev Kamenev. Lenin and Zinoviev were still able to engage in party activity via correspondence. The remaining members of the Central Committee were able to set up shop in an apartment outside the center of Petrograd and more or less resume their activities as normal. So far, we've discussed what was happening to the Bolshevik Party during this period. We will end today with a discussion of the internal reorientation happening within the party itself. After nearly joining an insurrection doomed to failure, obviously, serious questions needed to be hashed out. To this end, on the 13th and 14th of July, a secret party conference to discuss the political situation was convened by the Central Committee and attended by the committee, the military organization, that arm of the Bolshevik Party that was responsible for organizing within the armed forces, and representatives from the Petrograd and Moscow party branches. Although no official records or minutes of the meeting exist, we know from contemporary accounts that the main question discussed was the attitude the Bolshevik Party should now take to the provisional government and the Soviets. Lenin argued that the Soviets, controlled by the SRs and Mensheviks, could no longer be trusted with power. He believed that the possibility of a peaceful transfer of power to the Soviets as a vehicle for the dictatorship of the proletariat was gone, and that now the Bolsheviks must prepare for armed insurrection, not in the near term, but as a long-term strategic goal. However, his views were in the minority among the delegates of the conference, and ultimately the conference adopted a more conciliatory tone toward the other socialist parties. The conference produced and proliferated throughout the Bolshevik Party across Russia a non-binding resolution which still condemned the actions of the other quote-unquote socialist parties and the government, but expressed hope of winning the Mensheviks and SRs back over to the side of the workers and away from the bourgeoisie. In response, Lenin, in an essay titled On Slogans, forcefully restated his position, arguing vehemently that the slogan the Bolsheviks had been using before the July days of all power to the Soviets must be abandoned, since the Soviets, as constituted at that moment, were controlled by the SRs and Mensheviks, and they had been exposed as collaborators with the now thoroughly counter-revolutionary provisional government. I toyed with the idea of including the full text of this essay as a supplemental to this episode, but decided against it because the document is more about a specific tactical question at a precise moment in time during the revolution, and not something that was pivotal to the course of events or sheds light on the topic at hand, which is mostly how I envision the supplementals. But damn it if Lenin is not a fantastic writer and crystal clear in the exposition of his ideas. And so, of course, I had to give everyone a taste of him in his own words. What follows is a lengthy quote from On Slogans. Quote, "The Soviets, in their class composition, were organs of the workers' and peasants' movement, a ready form for their dictatorship. Had they had total power, the main weakness of the petty bourgeois strata, their main sin, the trusting attitude toward the capitalists, would have died out in practice. It would have been criticized by the experience of their personal undertakings. The change of classes and parties having power inside the Soviets could have, on the grounds of their unified and absolute authority, gone peacefully. The connection of all Soviet parties with the masses could have remained stable and unabated. One cannot for a minute lose sight of the fact that only the tightest connection of the Soviet parties with the masses, one growing freely in breadth and depth, could have helped the illusion of petty bourgeois appeasement of the bourgeoisie die out peacefully. The transfer of power to the Soviets would not and could not have changed by itself the relationship between the classes. It could not have changed anything in the petty bourgeois nature of the peasantry. But in due time, it would have made a massive step toward the estrangement of the peasants from the bourgeoisie, and toward their convergence, and then unification, with the workers. Thus it could have been, if in due time power had gone over to the Soviets. This would have been easiest of all, and the most advantageous for the people. Such a path would have been the least painful, and therefore should have been fought for as energetically as possible. But now, this struggle, the struggle for the timely transfer of power to the Soviets, has ended. A peaceful path of development has been made impossible. A non-peaceful, most painful path has begun. The turning point of the 4th of July consists of precisely the fact that, after this date, the objective situation has changed entirely. The vacillating state of power has ended. Power has gone into the hands of the counter-revolution in a decisive manner. The development of parties on the grounds of appeasement of the counter-revolutionary cadets by the petty bourgeois parties of the SRs and the Mensheviks has led to both these parties becoming de facto participants and enablers of the counter-revolutionary butchery. The unconscious, trusting nature of the petty bourgeoisie toward the capitalists has led the former, in the course of the development of the party struggle, to their conscious support of the counter-revolutionaries. The slogan of transfer of power to the Soviets would sound now like something from Don Quixote, or like a mockery. This slogan would objectively be a deception of the people, the instilling of the illusion that now it is enough for the Soviets to wish to take power, or to decree it, in order to receive it, as if there are still parties in the Soviet which have not stained themselves by enabling the executioners, as if it is possible to undo what has been done. End quote. Lenin goes on to say that the most important thing in a revolution is an honest accounting of power, and insists that, 1. It must be admitted that the provisional government now has the power, supported by the Soviets, which are under the control of the SRs and Mensheviks. 2. The other socialist parties have been exposed as petty bourgeois parties, have betrayed the workers and peasants, and cannot be trusted again. And 3. These facts must be explained to the workers, and obscuring or downplaying them constitutes a betrayal of the workers' movement, since the movement can only be served properly by the truth. Toward the end of the essay, he still defends the Soviets as an institution and vehicle for workers' power, but is adamant that with the SRs and Mensheviks currently in the majority, the Soviets absolutely cannot be trusted with power. Quote, the Soviets can and must appear in a new revolution, but not the current Soviets, not the organs of collaboration with the bourgeoisie, but the organs of a revolutionary struggle with them. That we will then be in favor of a construction of the entire state along the lines of the Soviets is true. This is not a question of the Soviets in general, but a question of the struggle with the counter-revolution and betrayal of these Soviets. End quote. If we recall Lenin's activities from April, we can see that he is struggling against tendencies of opportunism and appeasement within the Bolshevik Party. However, now that he is no longer on the scene personally, his ability to lead this struggle has been weakened. Thus, the non-binding resolution from the party meeting in mid-July was a rhetorical victory for those tendencies. To be fair, it is not the case that every single Menshevik and SR party member in the capital supported everything the leaderships of those parties were doing to aid the government. There were some who spoke out, in articles and at meetings, in defense of the Bolsheviks, or at the very least, called for those imprisoned to either be tried or released. In particular, left SRs and Menshevik internationalists, left-leaning offshoots of those parties, were braving the backlash and working to temper the fury being aimed at the Bolsheviks. And I promise we will have an episode on these two groups soon. But in the main, the idea of reconciling with the SRs and Mensheviks, after they had sided with the government and the bourgeoisie, struck Lenin as a naive, insane, and possibly dangerous notion. And with the help of his essay, much of the rank and file of the party tended to agree with him. Debate raged at district and factory meetings all around Petrograd. Should the Bolsheviks try to salvage some sort of relationship with the other socialist parties? Try to win at least some of them over? Or was it time for the party to forge its own independent path forward? As an American, this debate reminds me of nothing so much as the question that comes up constantly, but especially every 4 years or so, of whether the Democratic Party is salvageable, and progressives and working-class people should ally with the party as the best chance of achieving their goals, or whether workers and unions should break away and form their own party. Of course, one of the key differences between Russia in 1917 and the United States in the 21st century is that in Russia, there was a plurality of different parties that each represented progressives, leftists, socialists, workers, etc., whereas in the U.S., the Democrats are just sort of a catch-all party for the so-called center and the so-called left. The Bolsheviks were not facing the prospect of breaking away from a larger party. They were debating whether they could or should try to build alliances with parties who had just thrown their lot in with a government that was increasingly counter-revolutionary. But even this echoes the refrain we hear from Democratic strategists all the time, that the winning strategy is to go after, quote, moderate Republicans, that the Democrats simply must appeal to them and try not to scare them away by being too, quote, radical, as if this tiny sliver of the electorate holds the key to victory for a party that is supposed to represent the working class. This podcast is not about American politics, and so I will refrain from sharing my personal thoughts on the modern Democratic Party and the strategies they pursue. But I do think it is incredibly helpful and important to draw historical parallels in order to make the history we learn, any history, not just Soviet history, more relatable and of more practical use. And this comparison jumped out at me, so I had to mention it. But while I will not comment on modern American politics, I will spoil the ending of our story here a little bit by pointing out that ultimately, the Bolsheviks do not make serious efforts to reconcile with or win over the other, quote, socialist parties. And, well, we know who prevails in the revolutionary class struggle in the end, don't we? The debate on what relationship to have with the other socialist parties was only officially settled at the 6th Party Congress, which was held in Petrograd from the 26th of July to the 3rd of August. By the end, after days of intense back and forth, the party officially withdrew the slogan, "All Power to the Soviets," in favor of the slogan, "Complete Liquidation of the Dictatorship of the Counter-Revolutionary Bourgeoisie." And yes, this slogan is comically long and just as much of a mouthful in the Russian. The Congress also reaffirmed the party's commitment to a socialist revolution, although it lacked any specific details like how and when, not surprising given everything that had happened in the previous weeks. But one thing that must be made very clear here is that while the party officially withdrew its slogan "All Power to the Soviets," thereby signaling the party's distrust of them, many rank-and-file workers, Bolshevik and non-Bolshevik alike, still conceived of the Soviets as a vehicle for the revolution, and so did not abandon the notion of the Soviets eventually taking over. Much like in Lenin's essay, the dream of the Soviets as a vehicle for a popular revolution was not dead yet. Okay, as we head into the final leg of this episode and get to the exciting finale of the Bolsheviks' triumphant political comeback, we've gone through such an action-packed few weeks that I think a brief summary would be helpful. After the failure of the insurrection of the 3rd to the 5th of July, the provisional government, aided by the SRs and Mensheviks and the Soviets, talked a big game, promising that the Bolsheviks as a political force were done for, and Kerensky himself promised to do away with them in short order. Authorities looked the other way as far-right Black Hundreds engaged in violence against workers and leftists in the streets of Petrograd. Factory and business owners took advantage of the moment to reassert their dominance over their workforces, and even military officers went rogue. However, Kerensky and his government lacked the material means to actually make good on his promise. The Bolsheviks were thrown into disarray after the July days, but in an environment where workers did not abandon them and the government was not able to defeat them decisively, they managed to endure. And after some reorientation in goals and strategy, the Bolsheviks emerged from the aftermath of the insurrection in a much stronger position than anyone would have expected. The provisional government, in the meanwhile, was still massively unpopular. Attempts at disarming the workers, the continuation of the war, harassment and arrests of Bolsheviks, and the summary executions of soldiers suspected of involvement in the insurrection, all this combined to hammer home to the workers that the government was not, in fact, serving their interests. And since the SRs and Mensheviks had sided with that government, that left the Bolsheviks as the only opposition that could be trusted. The only thing missing in this scenario is some singular political moment, some event where all the people in cities around the country, but especially the capital, could voice their opinions on who should hold political office, some kind of, what's the word, big voting decision event, like an election. That's the word, an election. An election that would show who had the most support from the general population. Wait, what's this on the calendar? An election for the Petrograd City Duma, scheduled for the 20th of August? The first portents of the Bolsheviks' political recovery actually came at a meeting of the workers' section of the Petrosoviet on the 7th of August, which was the section's first meeting since the July days. To the consternation of the Mensheviks and SRs, the Bolsheviks were able to influence the agenda and first force, and then win, votes on a resolution calling for the release of leftists and Bolsheviks still awaiting trial, and a resolution condemning the reinstitution of the death penalty in the army, as well as the Mensheviks and SRs for supporting this move. Then came the municipal elections to the Petrograd City Duma, which, as I said just a moment ago, took place on the 20th. Now, some of you may be confused that the Bolsheviks are participating in government elections, since the central theme of the entire revolution has been that the Bolsheviks have eschewed participation in and association with the provisional government. However, we're not talking about the provisional government here, but instead about local municipal elections. An analogy for Americans, and apologies to any non-Americans listening that I keep giving analogies based on American politics, but I gotta go with what I know, is imagine there was an openly socialist party in the US which explicitly disavowed the presidency and the Congress, refusing to even put up members for election because these institutions are too corrupt, and the new joining them would only dilute and weaken their political effectiveness. But they still insisted on campaigning for city councils and other local offices in order to have some political presence and to help entrench themselves in local government. That's what the Bolsheviks are doing here. The Petrograd City Duma is basically the local city administration. Oh, but not a city council, because that's literally what the Petrosoviet is. Well, except the Soviets aren't official, they are just supported by the masses, while the Duma is part of the official post-Tsar government. So, yeah, sorry, it's the whole dual power thing again. Anyway, in Petrograd, in articles and speeches and at meetings, the Bolsheviks made the Duma elections a referendum on the revolution, urging voters to cast ballots for them in order to make a strong recommitment to the ideals of the revolution, and to repudiate the counter-revolutionary measures of the last 7 weeks. When the votes were tallied, the Bolsheviks had won 67 seats in the Duma, behind only the SRs, who had won 75 seats. The cadets won 42 seats, and the Mensheviks had only 8. It was generally acknowledged in the press in the days after the election, even by the Mensheviks and cadets, that the Bolsheviks had won a massive and impressive electoral victory. Yes, they were second, but they weren't even expected to win 10 seats just a few weeks ago. Sorry, Mensheviks, that's got a sting. But the Petrograd City Duma was not the only election in which the Bolsheviks participated. In other municipal elections across the country, which, to be clear, did not all take place on the 20th of August, just around that time, the Bolsheviks had mixed results. They had abysmal showings in Kiev, Vladimir, Yaroslavl, Odessa, Samara, and Tula, winning only a tiny portion of the vote and the seats that were available in each location. In other cities, however, like Lugansk, Reval, which is present-day Tallinn, capital of Estonia, Nizhny Novgorod, Ivanovo-Voznesensk, and Tver, the Bolsheviks had more respectable showings in local elections, garnering from nearly one-third of the vote in Reval to an outright majority of 60% in Ivanovo-Voznesensk. Overall, from an electoral standpoint, since defeats in certain cities were canceled out by victories in others, and since they won an impressive come-from-behind second place in Petrograd that was practically viewed as a win, the Bolsheviks never suffered the kind of overall crushing national defeat and repudiation that could have doomed them. So yeah, I think it's fair to say, the Bolsheviks are back. And I have to say, their comeback was just in the nick of time. Because in a little over a week after the Petrograd City Duma elections, an existential threat suddenly reared its head and let out a menacing bellow against not only the Bolsheviks, but the entire working population of Petrograd, leftists of all stripes, and even the socialist-in-name petty bourgeois-in-action parties of the SRs and Mensheviks. Had this threat been successful in doing anything more than rearing its head and letting out a menacing bellow, the Russian Revolution likely would have ended right then and there. The entire working population of first Petrograd, and then the country, would likely have been culled, very much like the communards of Paris in 1873. But instead, the people of Petrograd, led by the resurgent Bolsheviks and even joined by the other so-called socialist parties, were able to band together and meet this threat head-on, and stop it so thoroughly in its tracks that, mere days after it appeared, as quickly as it had appeared, it vanished as if it had never been there. But, dear listener, that was just a teaser. I am sure many of you already know what this existential threat is, but we will have to put it off for an episode. Because to fully set the stage for this threat, we need to go back and look at what exactly the provisional government of Russia was up to in July and August. After all, existential threats do not just come out of nowhere. Thank you so much for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. This entire project is run only by me in my spare time, and in practicing my anti-capitalist values, I will never run ads. So regular contributions allow me to devote more time, energy, and resources to making the show the best it can be. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. If you'd like to get in touch, you can write me at sovietpod@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.